This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Donald Trump held a second rally in central Florida in the space of a week, rousing supporters in Kissimmee just days after Hillary Clinton made an appearance. He also attended a faith group event branded anti-LGBT by the LGBT community. Like two Olympic swimming rivals dashing up and down a pool, Trump and Clinton are neck and neck in the polls in Florida. But Trump supporters, are there gaps appearing in the platform as your candidate comments on the Second Amendment? And Hillary fans, are you worried about the optics of the father of the Pulse nightclub shooter being spotted on live TV at the Clinton campaign event? Meanwhile, some Republicans are lining up behind Hillary Clinton. Others are trying to distance themselves from some of Trump's comments. And Marco Rubio, who spent the dying moments of his presidential primary campaign roasting the Donald, has done a full 180 and is supporting him. If you were in the Rubio camp before, are you still there now? Is there any movement left in the Never Trump movement that animated Rubio supporters just a few months ago? And what do you make of the senator's appearance at an event slammed by the LGBT community? We're taking your calls on Clinton, Trump and Rubio later in the show. What questions were you hoping the release of the Pulse autopsy reports would answer? What hopes do you have for the Indian River Lagoon now that Brevard County Commissioners have an expensive cleanup plan on the ballot? We're at 1-866-338-5252. That's 1-866-338-5252. Well, with me in the studio, Beth Kasser, columnist with the Orlando Sentinel. Welcome back, Beth.
Thanks for having me.
Also joining us from his office, communications director at Beacon College and columnist at FloridaPolitics.com, Daryl Owens. Welcome back, Daryl.
Good to be back, Matt.
And also in the studio with us, Matt Reed, columnist and host of The Matt Reed Show at Florida Today. Welcome back, Matt.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You can join the conversation too. 1-866-338-5252 is the number. That's 1-866-338-5252. Well, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump brought their political roadshows to Central Florida this week, both swinging through Kissimmee. Here's Clinton at a rally on Monday night.
Would you rather have a president who says you're fired or you're hired? I'm hoping you're going to hear a lot of the you're hired when I'm president, because that's what I want us to do together.
Well, anyone who lives in Florida will be familiar with the Jobs, Jobs, Jobs campaign platform. Is that what you want to hear from the likes of Hillary Clinton or from Donald Trump? Daryl Owens, let me turn to you first. You know, it's the economy, stupid, was the catch cry for Bill Clinton's campaign that was coined by strategist James Carville back when he was running. Do you see that as a winning strategy in this campaign for Hillary Clinton?
Well, Matthew, it might be if voters trusted Clinton on the economy, even with everything Donald Trump has done recently to self-immolate. Polls are showing that Clinton is posting double-digit leads on him, yet when you drill down to whom voters trust on doing a better job juicing up the economy, polls are showing Trump with the edge. So while it might be the economy, stupid, this election cycle may come down strictly to personalities. And in this race, voters concerned with the economy appear to be staking their claim on the candidate who lives by the art of the deal.
Daryl, I'm wondering too, I mean, polls aside, what are you seeing, what are you hearing, what are you reading to suggest that Donald Trump is kind of more of a trustworthy figure on the economy than Hillary Clinton?
Well, what I'm reading and hearing simply is people believe that because Donald Trump is a real estate tycoon, that he has a better handle on these economic issues, whereas Clinton is speaking strictly in theory or being tied or lashed more likely to Obama in what they see as a failed economic, his failed economic reign over the past 8 years.
What about this audience here in Central Florida, the I-4 corridor too? I'm wondering, you know, have Florida audiences been kind of trained to respond to this economic message over others?
Yeah, I think you could certainly say that you know, Governor Scott's jobs, jobs, jobs message and his administration's bent on reducing higher education to an employment matrix. Florida certainly have been conditioned to think in those terms. But, you know, the economy still ranks top of mind to voters in recent polling. But Trump supporters and others are rallying around issues like immigration and terrorism as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of immigration and terrorism, Matt Reed, let me just bring you on this conversation. A sharp-eyed television reporter spotted in the audience, just standing behind or fairly, you know, in the audience at that Hillary Clinton rally, Omar Mateen's father, that's the father of the Pulse nightclub shooter. Matt Reed, what are your thoughts on that? What are the optics of this? Of course, the Clinton campaign sort of disavowing it, saying, well, look, we had nothing to do with that. It's, you know, anybody's invited to the rally. People are free to come to the rally. But what are the optics of that? What does that sort of tell you about how this could play out?
It's terrible. How is this? This guy should be much better known than he is. This is a guy who actually was a candidate for president of Afghanistan and has spent years hosting an Afghani language television program in which he's taken some very stridently anti-American positions. And yet he's there. And, you know, I don't think it's going to change a lot of people's votes. It does just kind of murky the water for people who are on the fence about Hillary Clinton. But it definitely feeds a narrative among the very conservative people who are behind Donald Trump that somehow these Democrats like Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton are foreigners who want to destroy America somehow. And they're somehow in league with these people that want to harm us. That's absurd, but it definitely visually to those people who are looking for affirmation of that thinking, they get it with that. And that's just certainly not healthy.
Just speaking of people kind of literally standing behind the candidates at those rallies, we also saw when Donald Trump was speaking at rallies earlier this week, there were folks behind him kind of making faces at some of his comments. What are the optics of those people and sort of seeing their reactions too?
Well, I think these rallies are just, you know, they should just stop them. I mean, it's like every day there's a rally and every day there's a new thing to get ticked off about, some comment to get inflamed about or angry about. And it's like, I don't know. I think with Trump, it's almost like he's supposed to be this master strategist who's going to renegotiate these great deals on behalf of America. But the Democrats are just standing there with their fist out and he keeps smashing his face into it. I mean, and that doesn't look very smart to me. The more he just, the more the rallies have something to, for the left to get inflamed about or for the Republican establishment to get scared about, the less anybody's going to listen to his economic plan or anything that he really stands for in terms of how he'd govern.
Mm-hmm. Do you see this as election as a competition between the economy and national security for voters' attention?
Yeah, you know, you said jobs, and I think that maybe it's not jobs. I think most people are employees and they're already, you know, working for somebody and they want to see how their company might fare in economy. And presidents really matter, especially over in where I come from. You know, in northern part of the county, you've got the space program around Cape Canaveral. Mm-hmm. And a president's outlook on innovation, investment in space, that kind of thing is tremendously important. We saw what happened when the space shuttle program went away. Now we've got all these private companies. We're a year away from launching astronauts again. That's a big deal. At the southern end of the county, we've got these massive defense contractors like Northrop Grumman and Harris, those kinds of things. A president's outlook on having a strong, modern military is great for them. You just hope that, you know, you invest in that. We don't have to use it very much, right?
Mm-hmm. So. Well, let's turn now to Donald Trump's campaign swing through the Orlando area. The GOP nominee's visit came on the heels of comments about the Second Amendment and Hillary Clinton that Trump said was a call to get out the vote, which sounded like an incitement to violence. At worst, was it a joke that went down the wrong way? Is the media's response to it merely a sign that Trump is kind of an unconventional candidate for those Trump supporters? Is there a reevaluation going right now about this candidate? We're at 1-866-338-5252. Also on the topic of guns, last night at an appearance in Kissimmee, Trump talked about Pulse and the December mass shooting in San Bernardino. He said citizens might have prevented the carnage if they had been armed.
If we had bullets going in the other direction, number one, they probably wouldn't have even come in if they knew there were guns where the bullets could travel in the opposite direction.
Well, Beth Kassab, first of all, the numbers for the rally. This is a big stadium, about 8,000 seater stadium, and was pretty full looking at those pictures. What does a big turnout at a political rally mean for Election Day, do you think?
Well, from what I could tell from last night, this was another rally that appealed to Donald Trump's base. And I think that is one of the consistent things we're seeing at all of these events, is that they tend to appeal to the same people over and over again. It's the same kind of voter that is turning out at these events. And I don't know that these rallies are doing much to appeal to undecided voters or people who might have a chance of switching parties because they're still disgruntled over the primary on either side of the political aisle. So I don't know that it gets Donald Trump very far with voters who aren't already most likely to vote for him.
Donald Trump has made some comments that have been pretty controversial this week, too. One of them, it sounded like, you know, he was talking about the Second Amendment folks, quote unquote, and what they could do if Hillary Clinton was in a position to elect a judge that the conservative establishment would not like. What was your take on that comment? And I'm wondering, too, about, his kind of meditations on ISIS and the founders of ISIS, to speak. What are your thoughts on that?
Both of those are more in a series of increasingly bizarre and generally careless things that most of us before this year would never have expected to come out of the mouth of a presidential candidate. I don't know that you can argue that Donald Trump wasn't joking. You know, if you watch his events and his speeches, he tends to talk. And he seems to be trying to make a point, and then he just can't help himself. He kind of goes off on these little asides and tangents, and what he thinks are jokes, But I you kind of have to wonder if a presidential candidate should be making comments that could at all be interpreted as inciting violence or potentially inciting violence. And the comments he made last night about the shooting at Pulse, that is interesting. And that is a comment that he has made before. But I have to note, Matt, that it was after a similar comment that he made, right after the shooting, that the NRA actually came out and said, wait a second, we do not advocate that people carry either concealed or openly inside of bars where there's a lot of alcohol served and that kind of thing. I mean, that is a position that is too extreme even for the NRA. I also can't let that comment go without noting that there was an armed security officer at the club at the time that this happened.
We're going to continue the conversation in a minute. We'll also talk about Marco Rubio. A short while ago, he was in full attack mode against his primary rival, Donald Trump. Then he was retiring from political life. Now he's back on the campaign trail. He's supporting Donald Trump, so he says he won't campaign with him. What are your thoughts on that? Are you disappointed by the Never Trump hashtag kind of being flipped on its head and Marco Rubio saying, well, okay, we'll support Donald Trump then? We're at 1-866-338-5252. That's 1-866-338-5252. We'll also talk about Zika and what's going on with the Brevard County's plan to restore the Indian River Lagoon, or at least clean it up. That's when Intersection returns.
Support for 90.7 News comes from Florida Hospital, treating patients when a medical emergency strikes in 10 emergency rooms throughout Central Florida, including the newest location in Lake Mary on Reinhart Road. Florida Hospital provides a network of care to help treat cardiac and stroke patients when every second counts. More information is available at floridahospital.com/ER.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Nicole Creston. Good morning. You can take us with you anywhere you go throughout the day by downloading the WMFE mobile app. It's free for Apple and Android devices. Just search WMFE in the App Store or Google Play Store.
Support for 90.7 News comes from Lowndes, Drostick, Doster, Cantor, and Reed, legal advisors to clients of all sizes, public and private, across multiple industries, including banking, construction, hotels, restaurants, and more. A multi-service law firm proud to serve Central Florida and beyond. Learn more at lowndes-law.com.
Welcome back to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. We're joined by Daryl Owens, Beth Kassab, and Matt Reed. You can join the conversation as well. We're at 1-866-338-5252. We're talking this hour about Pulse, Zika, algae. We're also talking about the presidential campaigns in full swing in Central Florida right now. Also, Marco Rubio's bid to reclaim or regain his Senate seat in November. What are your thoughts on that? 1-866-338-5252. Well, Rubio fans, are you gritting your teeth as the Never Trump pendulum kind of swings back the other way? And I'm wondering, does this pose a problem for the senator down the road if the presidential election doesn't go the way of Donald Trump? What choice does Marco Rubio have? And what do you make of that post-Pulse appearance, both from Rubio and his trip to Orlando to speak to a gathering labeled as anti-LGBT by the LGBT community? We are at 1-866-338-5252. Daryl Owens, let me just come back to you for a moment. What does Marco Rubio stand to gain by saying he'll support Donald Trump?
That's a very good question, Matthew. I don't know. Perhaps he's looking to gain friends and family access to Trump's favorite tanning salon, or he may be angling for a spot in the Trump administration, since Donald Trump at one point said he'd love to have little Marco in his cabinet. But then again, it may simply come down to Rubio has been duped by the candidate that he wants himself blasted as a dangerous con man.
Do you see him risking his political future here? I mean, can he insulate himself a little bit from what Trump does by saying, well, he won't campaign actually with him? He's not even appearing on the same day at that faith group that's happening, that conference is happening in Orlando. So there's a little bit of distance between the two. Is it enough, though?
No, I think the tar will fly far. I don't think he can distance himself from the stench of Donald Trump. You know, whatever fuzzy calculus Rubio has used in hitching himself to Trump, as has his GOP challenger Carlos Baruth, also may be backfiring. You know, not only does Rubio's alliance with Trump mark him as someone who is aligned with someone who gleefully sows hate and misogyny, but you know, recent poll shows that Trump has become an anchor on Rubio's election bid. Democratic challenger Patrick Murphy has gained significant ground on Rubio despite Murphy's own political baggage.
Beth Kassab, some GOP leaders have opted to say they just won't vote for Trump. There's kind of a longer and longer list of folks saying they're going to do that now. Would Rubio run the risk of losing his re-election if he kind of took that high road and said, look, I'm just not going to throw my lot in with Donald Trump?
That looks like the calculation he's making is that if he's going to come out on top in Florida, a state where he was unable to get many votes during the presidential primary, then maybe he you know, if winning is what matters, maybe Trump is the way to get there. That looks like the internal calculus that could be going on inside the campaign.
Mm-hmm. Matt Reed, do you think the average voter cares about who Rubio supports? You know, pre-election, does that sort of factor into Rubio's own Senate race?
I don't know if the average voter does, but I think among Republican primary voters, you know, he had a problem in that he ran as a Tea Party candidate, really, in 2009. That was what propelled him beyond Charlie Crist. But then he lost that disaffected Tea Partier type Republican to Donald Trump in the general election. Here you have Carlos Baruth, who's going on television saying, I love Donald Trump. I'm the Donald Trump candidate, throwing himself full on, you know, that kind of brand. And Marco Rubio is probably looking at his chances in this Republican primary in Florida. He's not a Trump guy. He's probably ideologically very much like the 50 national security people who came out with a letter saying that Trump isn't the right guy on national security. But he needs to do something to try to reconnect with that side of the Republican primary voter. And if that's what it takes, I guess I don't think this is about supporting Trump. I think this is about supporting Marco Rubio.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to take a call here. We've got a call coming in from Orlando, and this is Tiffany. Tiffany, you're on the air. What are your thoughts on Marco Rubio's campaign at this stage? Tiffany, you're on the air.
Oh, sorry. I'm just trying to figure out how voters are, you know, able to look past all of the negatives that we heard about Rubio during the presidential primary and now be supporting him in such great numbers here for the Senate race mm-hmm. when, you know, a few months ago it was he doesn't show up for work, he's a horrible senator, you know, he's a traitor, he, you know, all of these negative things. But now it's, oh, he's going to be our next senator. So I haven't really heard too much negatives about him.
Tiffany, what about the, you know, he's running against, though? I mean, when you look at the range of options there on the ballot card, does it, maybe it seems that Marco Rubio is just the best option out of the bunch?
Well, I mean, Baruff is not known. He came out of the business world just like Trump did. So why are the Trump supporters not voting for Baruff?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the same numbers. So it's just a little weird.
Well, Tiffany, I appreciate your call. Thank you so much for weighing in. What are your thoughts on that, Beth Kassab? I mean, is there some kind of disconnect here between the dirt that was dished on Marco Rubio in the primary and, you know, I guess how he's doing in the polls at this stage? Of course, things are fairly tight, as you pointed out, between Rubio and Patrick Murphy on the Democratic side. But have people kind of forgotten what was going on 3 months ago?
I don't think they've forgotten what happened, but, you know, voters have to assess, you know, the question that's on the ballot. And Marco Rubio is more of a known quantity than Carlos Baruff. You know, unfortunately, Marco Rubio spent a lot of time during the presidential primary talking about how he didn't want to be in the Senate and he wanted to be president. And he didn't feel like his time it was worth his time to be in the Senate. And so and he said he was not going to run. And now he is running. I mean, there are a lot of contradictions there. And voters are going to have to make a choice about, you know, what is most important to them.
Mm-hmm. Matt Reed, Rubio has put some shoe leather into the Orlando area in recent months. So what about over on the Space Coast? Is he kind of getting out there and kissing babies and so forth?
Not yet, but I hear he's going to be swinging by and I'm angling for an interview with him. The Space Coast was one of the areas that propelled him to success back in 2009, along with, you know, Fort Myers, Pensacola, real Tea Party hotbed places. Again, you know, that's what worked for Marco then. He's got to figure out a new recipe today. I think that the dynamic that I see in Republican politics is that among Republicans, it's really, really important to be the most Republican. I mean, they value that kind of, you know, they're proud of being conservatives. They want somebody to be a conservative first. And like independents and Democrats just don't. This is not a thing for them.
Mm-hmm.
So I think in trying to, you know, support Trump while also being a Bush-type person, I think he's trying to show some unity and be the most Republican, right? And it could work. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I think this is maybe one of the most dismal races for Senate I think I've seen. You've got two Republicans and a Democrat who have very short resumes, and then you have Alan Grayson, who's his own kind of creature, and it's hard to know who you might be for in this one.
Mm-hmm. And I guess the Republican Party itself is kind of undergoing a few growing pains, if you want to call them that, or some sort of identity crisis at the presidential level, at least.
Yeah, I mean, when I talk to people, and I talk to a lot of conservatives and Republicans, and they keep wanting an outsider because the people that they elect aren't quite what they want. And they've got it, right? I've heard for years, we need somebody who isn't PC, somebody who's going to, you know, shake their fist at the world a little bit more, somebody who's not going to do the stupid things that, you know, the Bushes and some of the establishment people do. Well, they got it. They got exactly what they've been saying that they wanted, an outsider who shoots from the hip, says what he means in Donald Trump, and look at the effect that it's had. Republicans that I know are scratching their heads. They don't know quite what to do. If anything, I'm really struck by how many everyday normal voters, not political hacks, are honest to God going to the website of the Libertarian candidate and trying to figure out who he is.
Mm-hmm.
Not because as a protest vote, but to honestly find somebody who doesn't violate their core values that they might vote for.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting dynamic this year.
So 2016 could be the year where some, you know, third parties make some breakouts there. Beth Kassab, I just wanted to touch on the issue of Marco Rubio's appearance at this gathering of conservative Christian pastors in Orlando this week as well. Of course, Donald Trump speaking there too yesterday. Does it look like a misstep, though, for Marco Rubio? You know, right after the Pulse nightclub shooting, he was in Orlando saying that, like, this was making him reconsider his decision to step out of the Senate race and get back into things. Or is he just kind of getting back to his base here?
Well, right. This is about getting back to his base and, again, riding the Trump coattails a little bit. And we will probably see more of that in the next couple of months before this election is over. It looks to me like Rubio is struggling with this issue a little bit, although I have to say a lot of people who, you know, who want to see LGBT rights emerge as a huge issue in this election, and I think it's fair to say that has been the case, you know, they're going to draw a line in the sand with this, and it's not going to look good for Rubio. He was already confronted by a protester here in Orlando, if you remember, when he came to visit some of the Pulse businesses. And he handled that pretty well. But this is certainly a much more overt, you know, slap against people who really care about that issue. And that's a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Moving on from presidential politics and Senate races and talking more about Pulse, this week the final autopsies from the Pulse nightclub shooting were made public, the last of them earlier this week. For families, some questions answered maybe, but there are still some questions that linger over the response to the shooting. We're also going to be talking a bit later on about Zika and algae, those issues too. But back to Pulse again. Beth Kassab, just how important was it to get those autopsy reports, you know, out in the public eye?
You know, it's a good question. We talked to some of the relatives of people who were killed inside the nightclub, and particularly one mother said the reports were extremely important to her. She felt like people needed to know what happened, exactly what happened. Some of the relatives and families, they want to know exactly what their loved one went through inside the nightclub. I also think that as a newspaper, we have to hold up a mirror to the community and show them what's happening as well. We have to, you know, we can't turn away from the horror of the details of this thing. That doesn't mean we report on the exact, you know, every specific of what happened to every single person. But mm-hmm. if you read our coverage in the Sentinel, we drew some trends, we categorized these reports, and were able to draw some overall conclusions about what people went through inside the nightclub. And some people in the community, including some of the doctors at Orlando Health who treated the victims in the moments after the shooting, have been very outspoken about the types of injuries they had because of the weapon that was used. And, you know, I think we have to tell people the truth about that.
Mm-hmm. Matt Reed, some questions are still lingering, though. You know, one of the questions journalists have been puzzling over is this issue of friendly fire, whether some of the victims could have been saved if law enforcement had gotten sooner as well, whether some of them may have been killed by police bullets accidentally. Do you get the sense that those questions can be answered at some point?
Well, I hope that they are, because in the world of politics and policy, there are, as insensitive as it sounds, some really important answers that could come from autopsy reports, crime scene reports, and that kind of thing. For example, I just interviewed the President Pam Goodman, or of the President of the League of Women Voters of Florida. Mm-hmm. They have come out and called for some common sense gun control measures as a reaction to this. The fact that we know from reports that the Pulse victims suffered more than 200 gunshot wounds, plus there were shots that didn't hit people, is kind of breathtaking, right? When you're talking about the capacity of the firearm and that sort of thing.
And you have to consider, too, that most of those shots, from what we can tell so far, came within about a 15 to 20-minute period. Not every shot,
right,
but most. So you have to consider how many shots that is per moment from mm-hmm. a single shooter.
There's another question, too, and I hear it stated frequently as a matter of fact among the Second Amendment people who will argue back in policy circles against that, you know, gun control thing, which is that, again, this is their statement, not mine, that nobody in the Pulse nightclub fought back. Nobody rushed the shooter. This wouldn't have happened as badly if somebody in that nightclub had, you know, fought back and defended themselves. So from their point of view, it's all about how could people in that club have defended themselves? Let's talk about that before we talk about controlling guns. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think we know that yet. At least I haven't seen it reported. That information may be in the kinds of reports that are being released,
right,
in autopsies and that kind of thing. We as journalists just need to be able to ask that question of the documents and the data that's released.
Mm-hmm. Daryl Owens, let's talk too for a moment about the challenge of, you know, memorializing Pulse. Now, you wrote a column this week about how to memorialize another horror. This was the site of the Dozier Reform School in North Florida, where boys were killed and buried in unmarked graves decades ago. Just what are the challenges, you know, facing Orlando of where and how to remember these Pulse victims?
Well, you're right, Matt. Past experience from the killing fields in Bangladesh to the 9/11 memorial have illustrated the challenges of memorializing trauma scapes. You have to deal with the sensitivities of stakeholders, and you have to avoid memorializing the tragedy in inaccurate or inappropriate ways that dishonor the loss. And there can be hot debates over who and what gets attention. And as with Dozier, there can even be questions as to where to locate the memorial. In a lot of communities, there's the danger of a knee-jerk reaction, this need to quickly memorialize that can lead to a less than thoughtful end result. Mm-hmm. But in the end, Matt, each memorial site tells a singular tale of human suffering, loss, and resilience. And to be effective, it must connect with their viewers, the tragic past, for the viewers to be able to see that. And it must be able to give the viewers some present meaning. And it must also point to a more optimistic future. And I guess to accomplish that neat trick, the final memorial must honor the dead and chronicle their demise through a simple design that is accessible, that encourages questions and sparks dialogue with the visitor, and puts it all into a larger historical context. And as you can see, it's a pretty complex animal to pull off.
That's a pretty tall order, yeah. What about this notion too, Daryl Owens, before we move on from this, about identifying a city with a tragic event, you know, whether it's a shooting, a terrorist attack, a fire, a hurricane? How does, you know, Orlando, of course, has been consumed by this story with good reason for a couple months now and will be for some time. But how does Orlando move ahead, make sure the Pulse shooting doesn't define it, but at the same time kind of make sure that those victims aren't forgotten?
Well, memorials partly appeal to us because of our hatred of feeling powerless. So memorials, in a sense, are our public attempt to try to confine the power of the tragedy, to make meaning of it, and then to regain a sense of control. So Orlando, by embracing the tragedy in that fashion, you can make sure that the victims are not forgotten. And by embracing the tragedy in that way, you also make sure the community isn't defined by the event, by how tight our embrace of it is. It reveals the strength of our community's bond, even when we are horrifically attacked.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. When we come back, we're going to talk about Zika. Is Zika on your mind as you fire up the grill over the weekend or as you get your kids ready for school? Also, is Brevard County's $300 million plan to clean the Indian River Lagoon a good plan, and is it something that you, Brevard County residents, at least, would want to pay for? If you're going to vote for that sales tax in November. Also, Tim Tebow considering a turn to pro sports, but not maybe the sport that you might think he would. Intersection returns in a minute.
Support for 90.7 News comes from Duke Energy, providing grants and employee volunteers to work with local charities and outreach organizations. More information on Duke Energy is available online at duke-energy.com/community.
This is Intersection. I'm Nicole Creston. Good morning. In your forecast, partly sunny skies today with afternoon highs in the lower 90s and a 40% chance of scattered showers and thunderstorms moving in. Rain chances stay at 40% overnight with lows dropping into the mid to upper 70s. Similar conditions over the weekend.
Support for 90.7 News comes from VoiceOnics Business Phone Service and Systems, providing Central Florida businesses a customized phone system solution managed by concierge-level customer service. More information available at voiceonics.com or at 407-401-8588.
Welcome back to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. Joining me, Matt Reed, Beth Kassab, and Daryl Owens. You can join the conversation too. We're discussing the news of the week. Turning now to water issues along the Space Coast. So talk about Zika and Tim Tebow. He might have thrown his last pass for the NFL, but could you see him chucking a baseball? We're at 1-866-338-5252. Well, Zika, locally acquired at least, hasn't shown up in Central Florida just yet, but that may just be a matter of time. So are you rethinking your kind of weekend grilling activity? Your parents, are you taking a leaf out of Miami-Dade's book, adding bug spray to the school supply list? Matt Reed, we're hearing lots about Zika control in South Florida. Is it a big topic of conversation in Brevard County too?
Well, remember, Brevard County used to be called Mosquito County, and we have pretty massive mosquito control systems in a county department that is one of the reasons why that area is livable today. Yeah, they are planning moving. Among the things that they're doing over there is they're running more of these trucks through the neighborhoods that spray. We also have these large, they call them poundment areas. They once were vast salt marshes, but now there are small levees built all around them. Mm-hmm. And they will flood those areas to essentially drown the larvae and keep them from hatching. And so they're being very strategic right now. But it's still scary. You can't get all the mosquitoes, but they're really cautioning people to just patrol your backyard, patrol your own property. If you see anything that's holding any water, turn it over, get rid of that stuff, and you know, because you'll get mosquitoes faster than you think.
Mm-hmm. A couple of years ago, you know, during the foreclosure crisis, there was an issue with mosquitoes with these abandoned houses, right? Like the kind of things filling up with water, people not doing maintenance. I mean, I had
one right next door.
Right.
For a couple of years, it was like a jungle over there with a pool that turned into a nice green, crazy pond. And the only saving grace was that it also filled up with frogs, right, that ate mosquitoes. But it was very loud. And you're right. Not so much a problem today, but there still are a share of vacant homes over there that those pools can be an issue.
Mm-hmm. Beth Kassab, is mosquito repellent part of the back-to-school kit for parents in Central Florida too, do you think?
Well, as somebody who sent my kids back to school this week, that wasn't part of our supplies. And, you know, but I think that hits on an important point, which is being vigilant and doing some of the things Matt is talking about, such as making sure you don't have sideways turned garbage pail in your backyard that's letting water build up or something like that. You've got to do those things while not going overboard. Certainly, you know, people don't need to panic, but this is a serious issue. And there was a baby that died in Texas this week. So this isn't something that people can take lightly.
Is that what it's going to take in Florida for people to really take it seriously? I wonder what your sense is, Beth Kassab. Is this being taken with the seriousness that it needs to be right now?
It certainly isn't being taken with the seriousness that it needs to be taken with by Congress. They have refused to devote the funding to Zika prevention and mosquito control. I do think I would hate to say that we need to have deaths here before people take it seriously. I don't know how much more you need to see than a neighborhood in Miami where you have 20-something cases now of locally transmitted Zika, not people who were traveling. And I have to tell you, the birth defects that are associated with Zika are incredibly serious. I mentioned the death of an infant in Texas this week. I have met people with microcephaly not related to Zika, but people who have dealt with this, and it is a horrible, horrible disease. And the people are nonverbal. They, you know, it's just a horrible situation. And if you know, people need to be aware of what the actual risks are.
Mm-hmm. Darrell Owens, let's talk a little bit about what else is happening. You know, Matt Reed was talking about some of the mosquito controls going on out on the Space Coast. Seminole County just approved a resolution for some money for Zika prevention. That $200,000, I believe, would come from the state, though. Could you see residents reaching into their own pockets to fund more mosquito control if, you know, federal money doesn't free up?
I don't know, Matt. Seminole residents grumbled over shelling out for bear-proof trash cans, which bears, of course, were a clear and present danger in that area. So I'm not sure they'd be willing to cough up more cash for what right now in Central Florida is an existential threat.
Mm-hmm. What about, you know, theme parks? Obviously, Governor Scott's been pretty quick to quash any notion that tourists are going to be driven away by the threat of Zika. But would it be out of the question for theme parks, other businesses in Central Florida to sort of bump some money the way of Zika prevention, you know, keep this endemic disease from spreading out of South Florida into that tourism corridor?
I'm not sure that there is precedent for such a move, but considering that a virologist at Scripps, Florida, recently pointed out the potential of an outbreak that could rival the current epidemic in Puerto Rico, the prospect of theme parks ponying up some money for Zika might be a prudent move. Mm-hmm. But I must point out that just this week, Disney CEO Bob Iger told CNBC that Zika has had no impact on Disney's bottom line, and that might suppress the House of Mouse's appetite for sharing any of its cheddar.
Well, let's move on to something else that's troubling people, maybe not larvae in the water, but definitely some algae out in the water on the Space Coast and further south in South Florida as well. Well, this week, Brevard County Commission voted for a half-cent sales tax to fund a cleanup plan. That's after brown tide fouled the lagoon in March, killed thousands of fish. Tax hike goes to the voters in November. Plans are also unveiled to build water storage systems south of Lake Okeechobee with the aim of stopping the blue-green algae fouling the coastal estuary further south. Well, Brevard County residents, are you planning to vote for that sales tax in November? Is there a better way to pay for the cleanup? We're at 1-866-338-5252. That's 1-866-338-5252. Matt Reed, what's the strongest selling point for the sales tax? Is it economic or is it ecological?
Well, it's a little bit of both. I've never seen so many people from different political walks of life and so many different professions really galvanized behind the need to clean up and restore that unique estuary that is just the hallmark of where we live. The problem is that it's going to take some very significant civil engineering, particularly when it comes to these massive canals that were dug that drain farmland and subdivisions directly into the Indian River Lagoon. That water used to travel towards the St. John River. Now it's nitrate and phosphorus-laden fresh water pouring into the normally salty lagoon. It feeds the algae, and that's what's killing the fish at the north part of the lagoon and what's causing toxin-spewing blue-green algae down at the southern end of the lagoon. It's a bad situation. Now, I'm interviewing all kinds of political candidates, and one of the issues that is so frustrating is that that's the kind of thing that Amendment 1 money should have been spent on. Mm-hmm. None of it was. Because Amendment 1 gave the legislature discretion, and they used their discretion to spend, as we know, much of the money on old land purchases and to pay for ongoing agency costs for any sort of department that has anything to do with the environment. There's some money for the Everglades, which is great, but there was nothing spent on the Indian River Lagoon, and there doesn't appear to be any change of political will in Tallahassee over that. So if you're going to do these projects, how are you going to pay for it? I mean, we've got a county right now that is trying to go line by line through its budget to find any kind of money to repave its bumpy roads. And it's not succeeding at that. Mm-hmm. You can't add a $300 million 10-year plan to, you know, retrofit some homes that have septic tanks and connect them to sewers, or to dredge a lot of muck, or to, you know, build water retention projects. You can't do that from what's already in the budget. The key with this kind of a thing is you've got to somehow win the trust of that taxpayer over there, that their money's going to be used the right way, in a transparent way, and there's not going to be, you know, shenanigans with the money.
So what's your sense of this early stage, you know, several months out from November? Is this thing going to pass? Do you think voters would just say, no, we can't afford it?
Well, on one level, it has a little bit of a leg up over something like a school tax, which did pass over there. Mm-hmm. Because so many different groups already believe in doing something on the Indian River Lagoon. On the other hand, it's a conservative area that doesn't like new taxes. They don't often pass. So again, they're going to have to do a lot of campaigning between now and November to have for this to have any chance.
Beth Kassab, just picking up on a point that Matt Reed was making there about the political will up in Tallahassee. I mean, there is now this plan from Florida Senate President-elect Joe Negron for the state to buy about 60,000 acres of land south of Lake Okeechobee to store water. Of course, that would have to kind of go through the governor. What's your sense of whether that could succeed, that plan?
It's already getting some pushback by North Florida legislators who say that spending the money on land south of Lake Okeechobee would eat into their own water conservation efforts in the Panhandle. And this is going to be a long fight. But I think one thing we really need to remember is, you know, here in Central Florida, we cannot afford to say this is a South Florida issue or this is a coastal issue and we are insulated from it here in Central Florida. That's simply not the case. We send a lot of the nitrates that we produce downriver. Everything flows south. And so some of that is coming back to us. And in an area that is so dependent on tourism, we simply cannot afford for some of these images of the, you know, guacamole floating in the ocean to be broadcast like they are. You know, this is not just a green environmental issue. This is definitely an economic issue.
Mm-hmm. I'll take a call here. We've got Bill calling from Winter Park. Bill, quickly, what are your thoughts on this issue out in Brevard and how Brevard should resolve it?
Well, yeah, I'd like to address this to the gentleman from Brevard. He talked about the amount of civil engineering and how much money it's going to take. And, you know, my question is, the people in Brevard, are they willing to sacrifice non-monetarily for many years? I've seen on television talking about the lagoon. They go on a canal and you see St. Augustine grass that is fertilized right down to the waterline. They're all on septic tanks. Many of them are on septic tanks, and they fight going on sewer. Mm-hmm. So did the people of Brevard realize that they're a huge part of the problem instead of pointing to the state and other people? And would they be willing to give up that St. Augustine grass and that nitrogen fertilizer that they use? And are they willing to get off those septic tanks and go on sewer? So I'd like to hear an answer to that. Thank you very much.
Bill, thanks for your call. I appreciate it. Matt Reed, real quick in the last minute or so here, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, we already are seeing people recognizing that. Almost every municipality and county has passed a fertilizer ordinance, a summertime ban, and it appears that sales of fertilizer are way, way down. People are actually complying with that. They want to help the lagoon. So that's a good sign. Mm-hmm. And that is what you can do in your yard. And I think people are recognizing it. But your typical homeowner can't go reverse a canal that sends 9 million gallons a day of you know, nitrate-laden fresh water into the lagoon.
Mm-hmm. So this is bigger than just homeowners. It's kind of a statewide issue, as Beth was saying. Just before we leave the show today, from water to sports, one of Florida's favorite sporting sons, Tim Tebow, reportedly considering a return to pro sports, but it's not football. It's baseball he's thinking about trying his arm out at. Darrell Owens, Tim Tebow's been in the headlines for some non-football related reasons. Recently, he was in Orlando to bring comfort to some of the Pulse nightclub shooting survivors. What's your take on the revelation that he could be back in the sporting spotlight, or at least wants to be back there? Is it just an attention grab, or has he still got some life left him as a pro athlete?
Well, certainly that's what some critics suspect, that it's an attention grab. But I'm more inclined to believe that this move to baseball is his attempt to fill that competitive hole in his spirit. He didn't have the pro football career he craved, and now he wants to try to find that success in another sport.
Beth Kassab as a Gator. Is pro baseball where you would have expected to see Tim Tebow after his kind of NFL career?
Oh, wow. It's a good time to be a Gator. We got Spurrier back as a consultant in Gainesville, and Tim Tebow's making another run at pro sports. You know, I think people will enjoy watching this happen. Is Tim Tebow the next Bo Jackson who can parlay a football career into baseball or vice versa? I don't know. I'm hearing a lot of people say that's probably not going to happen. Tim Tebow has not actually played baseball, I believe, since his junior year in high school. Mm-hmm. So we'll have to see.
Matt Reed, in the last few seconds here, you know, there's the reported decline of baseball in popularity from Little League all the way on up. Does baseball need just a bit more of somebody with a big personality like Tim Tebow?
It couldn't hurt. Listen, I read his autobiography. I know his love of baseball is genuine. He had to give it up to go, you know, enroll early and play at UF. I wish him nothing but the best.
Mm-hmm. Matt Reed is a columnist and host of the Matt Reed Show at Florida Today. Thank you so much, Matt.
Thank you.
Also joined by Beth Kassab, columnist at the Orlando Sentinel. Thank you so much, Beth.
Good to be here.
And we're joined also by Daryl Owens. He's the communications director at Beacon College. Thank you so much, Daryl.
Thank you. Enjoyed the conversation.
Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. The executive producer is Catherine Welch. Production assistance for today's show from Nicole Preston and Amy Green. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.